Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome Dr. John K. Wilson. He's a contributing editor at academeblog.org for the American Association for University Professors. We'll discuss a recent report he did for the University of California's National Center for Free Speech and Civic Engagement on freedom of the press on campus. Of course, he's also author of numerous books on academic freedom, as well as press freedom. And we'll talk about big tech censorship and academic freedom in higher education. We'll talk about the fairness doctrine and the rise of right-wing media in the United States. Stay with us for an hour on the media, academic, and press freedom.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are honored to welcome John K. Wilson. He'll be our guest for the program today, and we're going to start by talking about freedom of the press on campus. But we're going to have a long, detailed conversation that hits on a number of issues around press freedom, free expression, freedom of speech, academic freedom in particular. We're later going to talk about things like the state of the media and the fairness doctrine, a history of the fairness doctrine. We'll even get into some specific cases about issues going on around freedom of the press on campuses. And we'll, of course, also include John's work about Rush Limbaugh. So let me give a proper introduction to our guest today. John K. Wilson is a contributing editor at academeblog.org for the American Association of University Professors. He was a 2019-20 fellow at the University of California National Center for Free Speech and Civic Engagement, and he's the author of 8 books, including Patriotic Correctness, Academic Freedom and Its Enemies, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason, and Trump Unveiled, Exposing the Bigoted Billionaire. John K. Wilson, you are also the author of the study you did for the University of California on freedom of the press on campus. Welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Glad to be here, Mickey.
John, again, I want to say on air, I am so happy to have you on the Project Censored Show this week. I appreciate all the work that you've done over the years, and I certainly appreciate your patience. I was hoping to get you on the show at some point last year, but I'm so glad that we were able to catch up today when you even have more of your work to share with all of our listeners. So, John Wilson, let's start with the study that you did for the University of California's National Center for Free Speech and Civic Engagement on freedom of the press on campus. I did a program on this with the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education last fall with Nico Perino. But how did this study come to be, the freedom of the press on campus? And maybe give us a little executive summary here. John Wilson.
Well, I've always been interested in campus newspapers and media. I helped start up various alternative campus newspapers over the years, long ago when there used to be alternative campus newspapers. And so I've been really concerned about campus media, what it says about freedom of expression on campus, and also what it says about the way that higher education is going. And if you look at freedom of the press on campus, it's partly about student newspapers and student freedom, but it's also about the corporatization of higher education, of how universities are viewing themselves as brand management and public relations prevailing over an idea of freedom of expression or freedom of the press. And so the study is really both about student media, but it's also about university policies and how they deal with the media and corporate media. And the student media side of that is really about a lot of the traditional attacks on student freedom, attempts by administrators to engage in prior restraint, the financial threats to student newspapers, which like other newspapers are under severe threat of going away. A lot of student newspapers aren't surviving the pandemic, and you'll see them only in online form in the future. And a lot of universities are using this as an excuse to take over student newspapers, to put them under administrative or faculty control and eliminate their independent status. And of course, one of the long-term attacks on freedom of the student press has always been the attacks on faculty advisors to student newspapers. It's one of the most vulnerable jobs in all of academia. If you ever want to get fired from a university, I highly recommend becoming the faculty advisor to a student newspaper because it's a great path to unemployment for a lot of people. And so there's been a lot of those kind of things, as well as a lot of other issues that affect student media that I wrote about in the report, of defunding by student governments as well as administrators, of trashing of student newspapers by people who want to keep them off campus.
John, by trashing, you literally mean what can be referred to as theft, because there may be groups or people that they'll go to a dispensary where if they have a physical newspaper and they'll literally remove the newspapers and throw them away?
Yes. Well, it can happen in all sorts of ways. Sometimes it's ideological. A lot of times it's when the newspaper is reporting about student government elections or about a crime on campus. You've had cases where a police officer on campus will toss out a newspaper that reports on something bad about a fellow police officer. So you have all those. And I experienced this myself a couple decades ago at Illinois State University. We put out a progressive student newspaper, and one day I was putting out copies and a guy came up to me and asked to see the copies I was putting out. And I gave him some and he threw them in the trash. And he told me that he and his friends were throwing them away because we criticized George W. Bush. And he was very proud of this. He gave me his name and spelled it out for me. He was so proud of his act of throwing away our newspaper. He said, "You have the right to print the newspaper and I have the right to throw it away." This is the kind of fear a lot of free newspapers always have. And whether they're progressive or conservative or centrist papers, you're always wondering about this. Those kind of phenomena have been around for a long time. There have been other kinds of trends affecting student newspapers, the growing threat of libel suits that have been coming about. There's an increasing trend where faculty administrators, particularly those accused of sexual misconduct, will try to sue the victims or the newspapers that report about them. And so you have an ongoing threat of that kind of use of defamation law to try and suppress news coverage. So there's all kinds of these different approaches. And one of the things that I do try to emphasize in my report is that not everything is hopeless, that there are ways to fight back. And often when you fight back against these kinds of repression of freedoms on campuses, it can really be quite effective. There was a case a couple of years ago at Mount St. Mary's College in Maryland, where the president was in a meeting with the faculty and was telling the faculty to fail underperforming students. He wanted them to get rid of the bad students. And so he told the faculty that they should drown them like bunnies and put a Glock to their heads. And this was then reported in the student newspaper. And the president responded by firing the faculty advisor to the student newspaper for disloyalty. What happened? There was such an outcry about all of this that the president ended up being forced to resign and the faculty advisor was rehired. And so this is quite an example of where great student journalists doing really important reporting that is very much in conflict with the administration. And sometimes that kind of good reporting gets people in trouble. But if there is opposition to it, if there's enough resistance to that kind of suppression, you can sometimes get a happy ending. There's not a lot of those in censorship of the media anymore, but there are a few cases like that.
So, John Wilson, just for full disclosure here, I want to make sure that our listeners know that I'm a professor of history and social science at Diablo Valley College in the San Francisco Bay Area. I am also the chair of the journalism department at my college, and some of the listeners, and certainly you know, John, DVC was in the news for some of these issues in the last couple of years. The reason I'm bringing that up, A, is disclosure, but B, there is a battle over campus media policies that you write about in your report. By the way, the report can be seen at freespeechcenter.universityofcalifornia.edu. And also, John Wilson, your work can be found at academeblog.org. So I definitely want to make sure that our listeners can find your really important work. But I wanted to get into a question with you about this very issue. You just mentioned about the firing of newspaper advisors. And again, more disclosure, I chair the department. I am not the faculty newspaper advisor. We currently have a full-time tenure track professor who is our newspaper advisor. But previously, and as you know, John, this is not just unique to journalism in college campuses, but oftentimes many of the faculty in higher education are adjunct faculty, contingent faculty, lecturers, a term that I don't use because I find it derogatory and pejorative, but sometimes these folks are called, quote, part-timers, end quote, and I don't agree with that term, although that I understand the context. But many of the people who are adjunct faculty are teaching at multiple places that add up to far more than a full-time schedule. The main problem is that they don't have the same protection. They don't have the same rights that tenured faculty do. And so do you see a trend in your study where the people, particularly the faculty members that were being targeted, adjuncts, contingent, without rehire rights, or do you actually see people with tenure track or tenured positions that were being attacked and sacked as a result of student news coverage?
I think in general, it's the adjunct faculty, the contingent faculty, who are the most vulnerable. Sometimes you will have tenured faculty who are removed as the faculty advisors. They're not necessarily fired. But more often, the loss of position is about the contingent faculty. And you see a big trend among campus media advisors. Increasingly, these are contingent faculty rather than tenured or tenure track faculty. And even more common nowadays, they're not even having faculty at all. It's administrative staff who are the campus media advisor.
That seems very problematic.
It's problematic for the issue of freedom of the press. For the administration, it sounds like a perfectly great solution. Yeah. Someone who works for them who can do what they want. And that's what you see is a huge burgeoning and increase in the administrative staff at universities and a decline in the tenure track staff. That's part of the issue with a lot of the campus media policies that I also write about and critique. And these are the policies that universities have that are primarily aimed at the professional media, the local or national media who are covering the university rather than the student media. Universities are increasingly have large public relations staffs. They want to manage their brands and manage the news. And so they want to exercise these kind of controls. And you're seeing more and more of these attempts to regulate the professional media on campus, as well as regulating who's allowed to talk to them. And so you have universities adopting formal or informal policies that really tell staff and even faculty in some cases that they're not allowed to talk to the media, that you have to send them to the public relations office, and that tell the media that you're not allowed to just talk to anybody you want to, and that restrict your access to campus. So you have a number of private universities, including the leading universities in the country, that have policies that prohibit media from coming on campus without permission. And these are universities that allow the public to come on campus and take photos and go on campus tours and walk around the campus. The only people who are restricted from going on campus are the media, and they're the only ones who have to get permission to come on campus.
So, John Wilson, you made an important distinction, private versus public. Of course, people that are in higher education maybe understand that distinction, but perhaps some of in our audience do not. Could you briefly delineate that for our listeners, the difference between the two and how it impacts these rights?
Public universities have to follow the First Amendment. So they're restricted in that sense that they have to provide some sort of protections for freedom of the press and freedom of speech. And so they have a legal obligation to do that. And so it's much more difficult for them to have very restrictive policies. And most of the restrictive media policies you'll find are at private colleges who can do whatever they want. They're not restricted by the First Amendment. However, there are cases with public colleges that have done this. A couple of years ago, Nassau Community College tried to enact a very restrictive policy prohibiting faculty and staff from talking to the media without permission. And this was resisted by the AAUP chapter there and many others, and eventually was reversed. But it's an example of how even public universities and public colleges, you see these kind of efforts.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today, for the hour, we're speaking with scholar John K. Wilson. Right now, we are discussing a recent study that he conducted for the University of California's National Center for Free Speech and Civic Engagement. It was published last fall. It's called Freedom of the Press on Campus. We'll continue our conversation with John K. Wilson after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome John K. Wilson, media scholar. He is a contributing editor at academeblog.org for the American Association for University Professors. He was a 2019-20 fellow at the University of California National Center for Free Speech and Civic Engagement, where he authored an important report on freedom of the press on campus, which is actually what we're talking about right now in this segment. Later in the program, we'll talk about some more of John Wilson's work, because he is the author of 8 books, including Patriotic Correctness, Academic Freedom and Its Enemies, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason, as well as Trump Unveiled, Exposing the Bigoted Billionaire. John K. Wilson, before the break, you were outlining some of the important features in your report on freedom of the press on campus, and I'd like to pick up there. So there's a lot of intersection in your scholarship, in your research, between free speech, free expression, freedom of the press, the First Amendment. You were just delineating public-private in terms of higher education before the musical break. But of course, you are also then very interested in the overlapping interests of academic freedom. You are very attuned to the problems of censorship. So let's go back to your report on freedom of the press on campus. In many ways, a lot of the policies that you were talking about, the media policies that you were looking at across major college campuses in the United States, a lot of these policies are censorious. They're driven to create more of a restrictive climate, a climate of fear, or literally a climate of censorship. Could you talk about your views or your perspectives on why that's problematic in higher education?
I think it's important for universities to aspire to be centers of intellectual liberty, that it's essential to their mission in terms of teaching and educating and doing research and innovative ideas. And it's also essential to their social role as places in our community where dissent is fostered, where different ideas are heard. And so that's why I believe so strongly in the idea that universities have this core meaning of academic freedom that is not just a property right of the professors, but is a foundational principle that applies to every aspect of campus life, including media, but including speakers on campus, including the classroom, including research that goes on. The idea of universities, it's not that they're supposed to be an ivory tower that's separate from the whole community, but I think it is that they're supposed to be an idealistic place where you can have these kinds of controversial conversations that are so difficult to have in corporate America or corporate media or the rest of society, that the university are the places where these dissenting views are supposed to be fostered and protected.
And of course, the student newspapers, and I want to stress that because that's kind of the golden rule in the student press. The faculty advisor is that, an advisor. The journalism is done by students, and it's a student voice and it's student driven. But then, of course, as you're noting, there are these other forces that want to come in and play and try to guide or control what happens, whether it's the administration, a district, a college board, and of course, also faculty members. So in your report, do you talk much at all about student rights and the significance of student rights and the student voice through the student press? And do you see something, I don't want to use the word sacred here, I don't think it's necessarily the best fitting, but do you see something paramount about allowing students unfettered voices, warts and all, mistakes and all, and so forth? You mentioned earlier that college publications are often battlegrounds for libel suits and these kind of things. I know you're aware of far right-wing provocateurs like David Horowitz have routinely used college newspapers and advertising campaigns to drive wedges into communities for controversial views.
I should say about David Horowitz, I've often tried over the years to get him to run his advertisements in my newspapers, but he would never do it because his goal was to be censored. His goal was something extremely controversial, to have somebody draw controversy about it, try and censor it, try and ban it.
Like on reparations, like on reparations for slavery that led to his Dangerous Professors book 20 years ago.
Right. So he's not interested in getting his ideas out. He's interested in playing the martyr and being able to say that he's a victim. And I think people who want to censor him and censor his ads or that are doing a service to him. They're doing him a favor. And so I think that's one of the reasons why you should oppose censorship, is because often the people you're censoring want to be censored. They want the attention you're about to give them through censorship. Now, in terms of the freedom of the press, I think it is important to understand that, you know, freedom is not based upon competence. It's not based upon doing good journalism or making error-free newspapers that never have a mistake in them and all of those things. freedom is about the freedom to get things wrong sometimes, and students will get things wrong. And unfortunately, I think we have to understand that protecting that freedom is essential, because if you start to say, well, we're going to just put somebody in there and make sure they never make mistakes, there's always going to be that temptation to censor. You're always going to have universities saying that, well, criticism of the university, that's the biggest mistake of them all that we can't allow in our student newspaper. And you see universities like Liberty University, for example, one of the more repressive universities in the country, that control of their student newspaper because it was printing things that it didn't like. Even though it exercised immense censorship already, it had to step up the censorship because it was worried that giving any kind of freedom to these students was a dangerous thing. And so I think we need to embrace the idea that student newspapers are sometimes going to print dangerous things. They're going to print things that upset people, that offend people, sometimes for right or for wrong. But we need to give them the freedom to make those mistakes, to offend people and upset people, because if they don't have that, then they're not going to be newspapers worth reading.
In your report, you mentioned Liberty. You also mentioned the University of Missouri about protests and freedom of the press. You write about the AAUP censuring some of these, not censoring, censure, C-E-N-S-U-R-E. I want to make sure our listeners are hearing the difference between the two. What was happening in this case about protests and freedom of the press, do you recall?
The University of Missouri, what you had was a lot of the protests a few years ago over issues of racial injustice. So there were students, they had a big tent on campus where they had stationed a protest, and the students wanted to have a perimeter around the tent so that they wouldn't have people intruding upon them and all of that. And so one faculty member, Melissa Glick, who was supportive of these student protesters, helped to provide a barrier. That is, she stopped a student photographer from coming forward to try and take close-up pictures of the protest. And for that, she was eventually fired in a violation of due process. Essentially, the politicians ordered the university to fire her, and they did. And the AUP censured them for failing to follow the due process that to provide the kinds of protection. It is interesting to note that she apologized for what she did and that the protesters themselves changed their position. They said, we were wrong to keep out the media. We want the media to cover our protests. We don't want to exclude the media. And I think that's something that's very important for student protesters to keep in mind. There's a growing trend you can find in a lot of surveys of students thinking that the media should be prevented from covering student protests and that the protesters don't want to have the media around and all these kinds of things. I think that's a really dangerous kind of approach to take. In fact, protest movements need to embrace the media and welcome them in and respect freedom of the press. It's the administration that wants to suppress these kind of stories. And so I think it's very much a mistaken approach for a lot of protesters who want to prevent the media from covering them.
So John K. Wilson, again, in your report, you also, and you've mentioned this earlier, you talk about attacks on campus advisors, media advisors, defunding of student publications. That sounds fairly blatant, but yet you have a number of cases here. So this is when an administration at a college decides to just cut funding. How does this work?
Well, there's a couple of ways it can happen. One is through the administration defunding. The other is through the student government. Sometimes you'll have student government that's upset by media coverage and newspaper of them in particular, and they'll respond by trying to cut the funding for the paper. And there have been certainly cases where that's happened. There have been fights about that. For the administration, in some ways, it can be a mixture of motives. Sometimes it is about trying to suppress the press. I've done alternative campus newspapers that lost funding and tried to go online only and immediately disappeared. It can be very hard to sustain online publications. I'm a big believer in the importance of print publications. And I hope after the pandemic, colleges resume to having these print publications, but they are fading away because of the problem of trying to fund them. It's more difficult than ever to get advertising, print advertising for student newspapers. And so it really does require a system of subsidies. And if a lot of universities want to cut those subsidies, whether it's to save money or to get rid of a dissenting voice, it's very easy for them to do that. And so I think universities need to understand that freedom of the press is not free, that you do need to spend money to create these newspapers, to create the faculty and other advisors who help improve them, and to make sure that these kind of publications are really a part of not just the university, but a part of the community they serve. In a lot of small communities that have lost small local papers, the campus newspaper is now the only newspaper. So they're really more important than ever, but they're fading away. They're under the same kind of threat that a lot of small corporate newspapers are under.
Indeed, that's an ongoing challenge. And we're seeing that here in the Bay Area. I mean, where there still are, of course, some legacy media, but you get out of San Francisco and go further east into Contra Costa County, there's a newspaper, but there's a lot of local communities that just don't have a voice. And part of what's happening with our program is that students are increasingly going out to do those kinds of stories. And so they serve many purposes, actually. John Wilson, one other thing that's in your report is defamation law. You write about that and how it affects student press. Could you talk briefly about the danger of defamation law?
Well, I think the important thing to understand about defamation law is that the real threat from defamation law is not from a newspaper losing a defamation suit. It's just the cost of fighting it. And that's the primary issue. The people who file defamation suits are not the ones who have had a great injustice against them necessarily. They're the ones who have enough money to afford to file a lawsuit. So you have, in essence, a kind of litigation vacation where people who can afford to spend a lot of money get to file suits for their own purposes or to threaten to file them. That puts a lot of newspapers in a precarious position. And the other issue that I think is an increasing threat is you're seeing a few colleges now that are starting to have defamation as something that's within their campus policies for student codes of conduct. So you have a few places like Middlebury just recently added it. So you can be punished for engaging in defamation. And of course, universities have never really dealt with or punished defamation before. It's a civil issue. It's not normally something that would be considered a punishable offense, but it certainly raises the question as to whether students, especially students who do journalism on campus, might be subjected to punishment for engaging in journalism.
And let's differentiate this, John Wilson, before we go to another break, in terms of defamation or speech. How does social media play into this? In this era of increased use of social media, college journalism programs utilizing social media platforms?
I think protecting right to use social media is very important because in some sense, social media has become the mechanism where anyone can become the media. You don't need a media outlet to become a reporter, to do journalistic work. You can do it on social media. And you can potentially get a huge audience for that kind of work. And so it's more important than ever to make sure that universities don't punish students for their social media, because those students may be taking the place of campus media or traditional media. They're the ones reporting on what's happening on campus and in protests and other sorts of incidents. And so I think there needs to be those kind of protections for social media to ensure that universities aren't punishing people for the expression of their views or for reporting the news.
Well, John Wilson, in our current so-called cancel culture, where this is all the rage, people taking to social media and saying things that end up impacting them professionally somehow at their jobs. And this is, of course, just a manifestation of this at the student press level, right?
It's important to understand that there's so much talk about cancel culture. Very few people understand that there's always been a cancel culture of the right. The conservative cancel culture has been around for a long time, and it continues today. And so we need to make sure that when we talk about political correctness or cancel culture or free speech on campus, we're not talking about conservatives being censored. In a lot of cases, we're talking about progressives being censored. And unfortunately, the right has in some ways hijacked the idea of freedom of speech, and they've managed to convince leftists that only conservatives are the ones getting censored. In some ways, a lot of leftists have bought into the myth of political correctness, the myth that only conservatives are the ones being oppressed.
I just want to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with John K. Wilson. He's a contributing editor at Academe Blog for the American Association of University Professors. And we're going to continue our conversation, not just about free press issues on college campuses, but we're also going to talk about the Fairness Doctrine. One of John Wilson's books turns 10 years old this year, his book on Rush Limbaugh, The Most Dangerous Man in America. I'd like to remind you, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. This is Pacifica Radio. We'll continue our conversation with John K. Wilson after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome John K. Wilson. He is a contributing editor at Academe Blog of the American Association of University Professors. He was the 2019-20 fellow at the University of California National Center for Free Speech and Civic Engagement. He's the author of 8 books, including Patriotic Correctness, Academic Freedom and Its Enemies, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason, and Trump Unveiled, Exposing the Bigoted Billionaire. The first half of the program, John Wilson and I were discussing the study that he produced for the University of California that came out last fall called Freedom of the Press on Campus. And we've been addressing a lot of those issues, but we're going to gradually segue here because John Wilson does so many things. But before we get into some of your work on Limbaugh, the Fairness Doctrine, and especially your work for Academic Freedom at Academe Blog, John K. Wilson, I wanted to give you an opportunity, if you wanted to have a few final words or a little bit of a summary about the study that you produced on free press issues on campus.
Well, I think freedom of the press on campus is connected to a lot of the other issues about freedom on campus and promoting liberty on campus. And in many ways, the campus newspapers are the canaries in the coal mine of freedom on campus. Universities that will attack the freedom of student newspapers are also going to go after the academic freedom of faculty. They're going to go after the freedom of speech of students, the right to protest. And so we need to keep a close eye on freedom of the press on campus to make sure that these kind of institutions exist, and also to make sure that we have the ability to report on these things, because there are a lot of cases of violations of academic freedom, suppression of protests on campus that never get heard about unless you have members of the media, including the student media, who are able to report on this. And unless you have these institutions around that are engaged in this kind of journalism. So I think this kind of reporting about what goes on campus is especially important to creating that climate of freedom.
Indeed. And John Wilson, at the conclusion of your report, you wrote, quote, "Freedom of the press on campus is an essential component supporting academic freedom, the right to protest, freedom of speech, and all the other liberties that are fundamental to the work of higher education." And that's in your report on press freedom on campus. You can learn more at freespeechcenter.universityofcalifornia.edu. John Wilson, let's switch gears into one of the other things that you do as co-editor of the Academe Blog, academeblog.org. You're a co-editor there. It's the blog for the American Association of University Professors. And you write quite prolifically there. Nolan Higdon and I, in fact, had a piece published with you all last year about the Zoomification of higher education and how it was impacting students and academic freedom issues across the spectrum. So could you tell our listeners, what do you do at Academe Blog?
It's a blog for the online component of the Academe magazine, which is the magazine of the AAUP. And so it's meant to cover all sorts of issues of higher education, but especially issues of academic freedom and intellectual liberty on campus. And so we try to run a huge variety of different kinds of viewpoints and ideas and current controversies that are happening in academia.
So there's plenty of those. And again, our listeners can go to academeblog.org to read more, not just of your work, but so many other people that are published there. So John Wilson, of course, one of the things that I wanted to bring up about academic freedom on campus as it relates to these press issues, just from your experience there and from what you've been writing about and publishing there over the last year, what are a couple of the biggest challenges that you've seen regarding academic freedom?
Well, I think we mentioned earlier about social media. That has been one of the critical areas, growing areas of academic freedom, especially for progressives. There's been an enormous number of cases where people are engaged with that kind of write a tweet and get fired for it. And there have been at least a dozen cases of that kind of thing in recent years where that happens. And a lot of it comes from people who are challenging the status quo. But these kind of cases come up in all sorts of different ways. Whether it's public colleges, private colleges, small colleges, elite colleges, they really transcend any sort of formula. And there is no college that's safe from the case where administrators or others want to suppress academic freedom. It's been particularly important in the past year, a couple of issues. One is the right to protest. And of course, the issue you are pretty familiar with, which is the censorship of Zoom and YouTube that has been increasingly a worry for a lot of universities because so much of what they do, both in their classes, their events, is dependent on these tech companies. And it turns out these tech companies don't have the same respect for academic freedom that a lot of these universities have come to expect. That's become a really worrisome component of what happens when the tech company you depend on to transmit your ideas is censoring what a university is putting forth.
Well, John Wilson, let's just go ahead and get into this a little bit more, particularly around Zoom first and foremost. You have written about this at some length dating back last year. And of course, a lot of this seems, of course, to have been exacerbated by COVID-19 restrictions, mass shift to online education, whether it be synchronous or asynchronous. In this case, with synchronous activities happening live, a lot of campuses, you know, Zoom stock shot through the roof, Zoom use increased gazillions of percent while everybody was sheltering. And of course, didn't take long before issues started to crop up between contracts that colleges or public universities had with these tech companies and then these tech companies' policies. And one case that came screaming to the forefront was Zoom censoring a public talk by a Palestinian activist and scholar at San Francisco State University. The event was canceled and also deplatformed by several other technology companies. And then even as a follow-up at New York University, the AAUP chapter there was having a meeting about the Zoom censorship that was also censored. So Zoom seemed to be pretty interested in not having people have these discussions on their platform. John Wilson, can you talk about those issues?
Both San Francisco State and at NYU, the controversy was over allowing Leila Khalid to speak, who is most famous for hijacking an Israeli flight over 50 years ago. And this is also where it's not just the tech companies on their own deciding to engage in this censorship, but it really is a coordinated effort. They were responding to government regulations that they believe required them to ban support for terrorism, which in this case means allowing anyone deemed by somebody a terrorist to speak, as well as a very strongly coordinated effort. You had dozens and dozens of groups writing to San Francisco State trying to get them to ban this event. And in this case, the administration actually stood up for academic freedom, but it was the tech companies that caved in. The tech companies have no particular benefit to them of academic freedom. For them, they would just rather censor something than deal with a potential controversy. That's an example of how the combination of government regulation and tech companies is not good for freedom of expression, whether it's on the left or the right.
By the way, if our listeners are curious about this case, John wrote about it at Academe Blog, and one of the titles of the piece is Zoom, YouTube, and Facebook Censor Event at SF State, September 23, 2020. And to the credit, I would say, of the San Francisco State University president, Lynn Mahoney, they seemed very disturbed and very concerned about what happened.
Well, that's right, but presidents of universities don't have any power over tech companies. They are, in essence, as powerless as anyone else. So it's much easier for them to take a strong stand because they don't really have any power. We're all powerless in the face of Zoom and Facebook and Twitter. They can do whatever they want, and we don't have any control over them. And universities are now incredibly dependent on them during a pandemic, as well as during other times, to use these events, to publicize events, to hold events, to make these events possible. And so it really raises a question of what universities are going to do if this kind of censorship continues and expands. Can universities develop alternative forms of technology that they control? Or can they persuade these tech companies to acknowledge that academic freedom is a real thing? There ought to be some distinction made that universities ought not to be subjected to this kind of censorship. So it really is an uncertain future as to what's going to happen.
So John Wilson, just last point on this. Early February, Academe Blog published a piece from the University of California Academic Senate's University Committee on Academic Freedom that addresses this directly, censorship by Zoom and other private platforms. You didn't write this, but I am curious if you had anything you wanted to say about the recent statement from the University of California about these issues.
I think it's a very good statement, and I think community standards of tech companies should not be the kind of standards of free expression that universities have. And at some point, if universities are going to use these tech companies to hold their events, they have to find a way to try and negotiate, if it's at all possible, a way to make sure that the university standard of free expression are prevailing and not what the tech companies are doing to try and control conversations on their campus. In some ways, tech companies are trying to do what universities already do, which is they're trying to monitor and control and moderate conversations that happen. But universities already do that. They already have systems in place to make sure you can do that without repressing freedom of speech. And so I think tech companies have a lot to learn from how universities have dealt with these kinds of issues and have dealt with the importance of free expression. And so I hope universities will be able to influence what tech companies do instead of the tech companies controlling what universities do.
Through negotiations, through contracts, I mean, we're talking about piles of money here, right? And in many cases, public money. So it's going to be a curious debate.
Right. And I think it's important to pressure universities to make sure they're living up to their obligations to protect academic freedom and protect freedom of expression on their campuses, whether it's real or virtual.
I'd like to remind listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm the host, Mickey Huff. Today's program, we're speaking with scholar John K. Wilson. He's a contributing editor at academeblog.org for the American Association of University Professors. After this brief musical break, we're going to shift gears again. We'll talk a little bit about YouTube censorship, but I want to segue into the Fairness Doctrine, and I want to look at John Wilson's work on the most dangerous man in America, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program for the hour, we've been joined by John K. Wilson. He is a contributing editor at academeblog.org for the American Association of University Professors. In 2019 and 20, he was a fellow at the University of California's National Center for Free Speech and Civic Engagement. Earlier in the program today, we were talking about the report John produced on free press issues on campus. We've recently been talking about higher education and technology and censorship through these kinds of tech companies like Zoom, YouTube, etc. And in the last segment here, we're going to segue and talk a little bit about the recent disappearance of the Critical Media Literacy Conference of the Americas, a conference sponsored by the California State University East Bay with scholars from Stanford, UCLA, co-sponsored by Project Censored, that was just completely eliminated from YouTube with no real discussion. And the irony there is that that conference was talking about online censorship. After that, we want to get into Fairness Doctrine and a little bit more about some of John's publications. So John Wilson, it is the case that Project Censored recently was dealing with YouTube to find out why our channel there on the Critical Media Literacy Conference of the Americas was literally disappeared without warning, without explanation, and in fact, with quite an Orwellian response. Alan McLeod, a media scholar writing for Mint Press News, wrote a story about this and contacted YouTube, and they basically said that they couldn't prove that the conference existed. They could only find one video. I mean, the whole thing was Kafka-esque. It was bizarre. At any rate, I'm just curious as to your impressions of this growing concern of deplatforming by places like YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, etc., and how it affects higher education.
Well, I think it's a very worrisome development. And it is an important point, I think, to bring up the issue of due process, which is a term you don't find much in tech world, but is a part of the AUP's long history about how you protect academic freedom. And you protect academic freedom, not just by having policies that say academic freedom is good, but you have due process. You have procedures that you have to go through in order to fire someone, to make sure they're not being removed for the wrong reasons. And that, I think, is a concept that needs to apply to the way the tech world deals with its suppression of free speech and censorship, to make sure there are systems of due process that people can go through and appeal to, that there are bodies, much like Facebook has created, to try and evaluate and look over these decisions. And when you have those systems of due process, those are even more important than just having policies that say we want freedom of speech. Having the due process to make sure that when things are censored, that there's an opportunity to find out why and how and to challenge it and to question it. That's what we need to have in the tech world, just as we need in academia. And as we see in academia, when you have contingent faculty who don't get due process, who can be fired on a whim, those are the greatest threats to academic freedom on college campuses. And the same is true in the tech world, that without due process, you're always going to have these threats to free expression.
Indeed. And that's where we are with this, is kind of in the dark. It was, again, ironic that you've got some of the biggest figures in critical media literacy scholarship, Kellner and Scher. My colleague Nolan Higdon was one of the major organizers. In fact, the previous Project Censored show for our listeners was all about this issue of this conference with Nolan Higdon and Alan McLeod as guests, for listeners that missed that and want to go and check it out. In addition, the irony here is that one of the keynote speakers was Sophia Noble, whose very well-known book from a couple years ago is called Algorithms of Oppression on YouTube deplatforming and suppression, particularly of people that are critical of establishment views, marginalized populations. So for us, we're still trying to wrap our heads around this. We think the irony was pretty incredible.
And it is important to point out that when you reduce things to these algorithms, when you try and reduce things to a formula, you often take out the concern about freedom of expression. It's hard to put freedom of expression into an algorithm, and often these tech companies don't. That's what you need to do, is you need to create systems, whether it's these appeal systems or monitoring or some ways of fixing the algorithm, so that there is a real concern about freedom of expression. Because otherwise, if you just let corporate tech companies make all the decisions and decide what's going to be, freedom of expression is not always good for the bottom line. And for these tech companies, you really have to make sure that they have some sort of important commitment to academic freedom, to intellectual expression and these kind of things, just as you have to do it with universities as well.
So, John Wilson, this kind of segues into a bigger topic about the Fairness Doctrine repealed in 1987 in the Reagan years. And of course, one of the things that happened in the aftermath of that is the rise of Rush Limbaugh and right-wing talk radio across the country. You've written at length about these issues, and part of the topical segue, having these kind of channels or these kind of things deplatformed by these tech companies nowadays is, I would say, at least somewhat analogous to the idea of removing entirely from the spectrum contrary points of view or differing points of view. Let's start with the Fairness Doctrine and then segue into your work on Limbaugh, who is seemingly at the end of a long career. And of course, our listeners may know he's not in good health now, and certainly we aren't talking about anything personally here. We're talking about these subjects. But going back to the Fairness Doctrine, you've got some interesting things to say about that. Can you tell us a little bit about the Fairness Doctrine, its disappearance, and what role that maybe had, if any, on the rise of right-wing radio?
Certainly, in being critical of Rush Limbaugh, there's a lot of progressives who are also very critical of the Fairness Doctrine. They see the removal of the Fairness Doctrine as being crucial to the rise of Rush Limbaugh and this right-wing media. I'm less convinced of that. The Fairness Doctrine was really enacted mid-century in a time of media scarcity. There are only a few channels. The excuse was, we don't have a lot of media outlets out here. Therefore, if you broadcast some controversial opinion, you have to also broadcast opposing opinions. This was a government regulation on the media. By the mid-80s, that situation had become far less tenable with the rise of cable networks, as well as eventually the internet that would come later on. There was going to be no way that the Fairness Doctrine would survive legal scrutiny under the idea of scarcity of outlets. It wasn't going to anyway, and it really wasn't enforced in any real way, especially it wasn't going to be forced by the Reagan administration and the Bush administration in any way to stop conservative media. So I don't believe it really was the case that Rush Limbaugh, although he got his start in national syndication a year after the Fairness Doctrine was repealed, he had already been doing a political talk radio show in Sacramento for several years before the Fairness Doctrine was repealed. And it wouldn't have stopped him from being on these shows. It might have had some restraint if it were actually enforced on radio stations becoming clones of Rush Limbaugh.
The studies, you know, you're familiar with. I mean, they were preponderantly one side over another.
Right. But it's hard to believe that government regulation would have solved that problem, because government regulation is very imperfect to begin with. It wasn't going to be regulated by centrist Democrats in any serious way, I don't think. If anything, you have to remember the Fairness Doctrine was something supported by conservatives like Jesse Helms and Newt Gingrich. And it's quite possible that if it had been around when Rush Limbaugh was going on national syndication, that they would have gone to all of these stations and said, you're a bunch of liberal media with liberal hosts. You need to put Rush Limbaugh on because of the Fairness Doctrine. So it could have been used by the right as easily as it could have been used by the left. It was an instrument of power. And so I think we need to be skeptical of the ability of government regulation to resolve what was ultimately an economic decision. These were stations, corporate stations. AM radio was dying in competition with FM radio. It couldn't run music anymore, so it needed to turn to something else. And that market that was there was for talk radio, and particularly for conservative talk radio that was very friendly to the advertisers on these stations. And so that kind of corporate motive is not something that you can eliminate through government regulation. It was always going to happen that you were going to have this rise of conservative talk radio in this particular moment when AM radio was dead, when syndication and satellite radio was technologically much more feasible and cheaper. This, in some sense, was an inevitability. Now, it could have taken a different turn. Rush Limbaugh, his own personality, he brought something really unique to that in terms of his skills as a radio broadcaster. But he really transformed radio by establishing that there was a profit for it. And there's no way you could eliminate the profit from corporate radio and get rid of Rush Limbaugh.
Your book, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason, turns 10 years old in March. Where are we with that culture? I mean, Limbaugh, he wasn't the first, but he was certainly among the more successful and prominent household names over time. And of course, we saw the rise of Roger Ailes and Fox News in 1996, and certainly a lot of copycat types like you've mentioned. You mentioned this Assault on Reason. What do you see the long-term impact of this 10 years on after the publication of that book?
Well, in many ways, of course, Donald Trump is the result of Rush Limbaugh, that he embodies a lot of what Rush Limbaugh stood for, this kind of racism, misogyny, especially though the anti-intellectualism, the conspiracy theories. Rush Limbaugh was not somebody who initially supported Trump very much, because Trump is not a conservative. He doesn't believe in any of this. He's a con artist. But Limbaugh didn't oppose him at first, and he certainly went along with him. And he liked him most of all because he was hated by liberals. That was what endeared Trump to Limbaugh most of all. But I think Limbaugh has had that incredibly destructive effect on the conservative movement more than anything, that he turned it into a much more radical, ideological, anti-intellectual, and that he really promoted this idea of people staying within their own zones, of never hearing alternative views. He really presented himself as the only media you needed to listen to. He got his followers to say, you don't need to listen to the mainstream media. I'll tell you what they're saying and why they're wrong. And so that was really the start of what was accelerated by the internet, of choosing your own media. And Limbaugh was the first one to really make that possible for people, that they could really just listen to conservative media and never hear these alternative voices.
Mediated hyper-partisan silos where people could choose to feed their confirmation bias without necessarily seeing other perspectives or views. John Wilson, unfortunately, we're running out of time. You've got so much to share with our listeners. What are a couple of steps that you would promote to mitigate this? We're just living in the din here. Social media noise and cacophony. This is the Project Censored Show. We talk about alternative media, problems of censorship, corporate control, critical media literacy education. What are a couple things that you could prescribe to people to be better informed, less likely to be duped by so-called fake news, propaganda, these types of things?
Part of it is listening to alternative media like this show. It's about trying to absorb different kinds of information. One of the things that Rush Limbaugh did that he was right about was don't trust the mainstream media. And he was also right to point out that a lot of radio at the time he came in was a vast wasteland, that he brought something different and interesting and entertaining about politics and discussing ideas that actually was a good thing. The bad thing was the right-wing approach that he took and the single-minded approach. So I would encourage people actually to not be afraid of hearing right-wing views and understanding why they're wrong. I've learned a lot by listening to Rush Limbaugh and understanding why he's wrong. And I've also had to do that, though I've had to listen to a lot of alternative kinds of viewpoints, leftist progressive viewpoints, to try and build that understanding. So I think there is a way in which we need to understand that answering Limbaugh and responding to Limbaugh, the solution is not to try and ban him and people who think like him and to suppress him. That never works. The issue is instead to embrace the idea of presenting alternative voices and to do it ourselves, to create our own media outlets. It is about more speech. It is about trying to promote those alternatives and to understand why we've gotten ourselves in the situation of a far-right crazed movement under Trumpism. It's in part the creation of Limbaugh, and we need to understand where that comes from, to understand why people have that, and to present different alternatives to them, to present understanding of why so many people found Rush Limbaugh and Donald Trump to be so popular, and not to imagine that we can solve it with government regulation or censorship of some kind.
And Limbaugh, in many ways, turned into a cottage industry, misinfotainment, very partisan, half-truth style presentations that were very flamboyant, appealed to a lot of people in the so-called heartland where AM radio thrived, where a lot of people were working all day in offices or outdoors or driving trucks. He was kind of filling a void for a lot of folks. And as the corporate press on television and cable became even more elite in some of its orientation. John Wilson, you've given us a lot to think about today, and unfortunately, we're out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to add here as far as contact info or anything that you think I missed in our conversation today?
I'm glad to have this conversation. I encourage people to look at academeblog.org to read all the various writings, including the people who disagree with me especially, and to try and engage in these kind of intellectual debates and to understand and try and help universities become places where these kinds of engagements with the broader community and engagements with dissent and make sure that dissenting views are heard on college campuses and they become a pathway for people to learn about this.
Well, John K. Wilson, I find you to be a scholar and a person that is modeling a lot of best practices around academic freedom and First Amendment issues. And it's been an honor to be in conversation with you today on The Project Censored Show. John K. Wilson, fellow at University of California National Center for Free Speech and Civic Engagement. That was 2019-20 with the Free Press on Campus study. He's also a contributing editor at AcadeMeBlog, co-organizer of the Evanston Literary Festival, as well as author of 8 books. John K. Wilson, thank you again for taking time out to share your views and your thoughts with The Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. I'm also executive producer of this program, as well as the co-founder with Dr. Peter Phillips back in 2010. Our senior producer is Anthony Fest. Our home station is KPFA out of Berkeley, California. I can be contacted through projectcensored.org. We also invite you to follow us and like us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We'd like to thank all of you for continuing to tune in. If you've got any feedback or ideas, please feel free to contact us. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, of the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, far for little poison, the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing, all the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, hypnotized by the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening, time's running out to reach all potential, if you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip our brothers and our sisters.